Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads, the Grateful Edition from the Circe Institute Podcast Network. I'm David Kern, and as always, I am joined by my partners in crime, Angelina Stanford and Tim McIntosh. I like that better than the inimitable because I just feel like it's more appropriate. I just feel like it makes more sense given the nature of, you know,
our relationship. It is a life goal of mine to be called a partner in crime. I'm super happy right now. I really feel like I've missed my call. Like, I could have been Bonnie to someone's Clyde. That's all I'm saying.
Well, you wouldn't have lived very long. Tim, how's it going?
It's great, David. Hello, what?
What'd you say, Tim?
I was going to say, I have successfully finished my cross-country voyage. I'm back in Eugene, and I'll be back in Seattle in 4 or 5 days.
Wow.
Done driving. I'm gonna be done driving.
So is the Seattle address the address that that you gave me to send stuff to?
Yes, that's the one.
Okay.
That's the one.
You'll be there before Christmas?
I will definitely be there before Christmas.
All right, you've got a Christmas present waiting there from me.
Okay, that's wonderful.
And I have successfully kept it a secret all this time. Yes.
It's not too late. It could still, they're like,
should I blurt it out?
It could be revealed. Right.
Still slip out.
Christmas party. I almost blurted it out to you. And then I was like, wait, I have not had confirmation that he received this.
Hey, by the way, we have like been talking on the Close Reads Facebook page about the gifts that we have received, but we didn't talk about them last week.
Yeah, that's why
he said this is the Grateful Edition. Yes.
Grateful Edition.
Oh, now I was like going to ask you about that. Of course, that makes sense.
Because we didn't get, we got those after we recorded, remember?
Yes, that's right.
So yes, for those of you who are not a part of the shenanigans over on the Facebook group, we need to say thank you once more publicly to everyone who was involved in the trickeration
and surprise of the century.
Yeah, the subterfuge, the surprise of getting us each of us some really great folio books. And now that I look back and see all the nonsense that was going on, I'm a little impressed at the way that they pulled that off. So thanks.
Okay, what did you guys get?
Oh, you don't know what we got. Okay, so Tim, why don't you go first?
I received a folio diary. Okay, so let me just describe how I actually got it. Apparently, unbeknownst to me, there was a secret Facebook collective of close readers.
The Jocos Reads.
Who were kind of tracking my trip across the country, and they kind of didn't know where I was going to end up when.
Yes, so because I just found out, and I can't stop laughing about this, that I was their source for where you were, and I was the worst possible source. I had them on the most wild goose chases, but I didn't know that they wanted something specific, so I was just very vague. And so someone contacted me and was like, so is Tim going to be with his family for Christmas? Now I realize they're asking me, are you going to be in Georgia, right?
Right,
so,
yeah.
Just answer, no, he went back to Seattle, which of course you were not back in Seattle.
Right.
And I didn't mean to say you were back in Seattle. It just meant you had started your journey back to Seattle. But little did I know then, that started the flutter of, oh no, he's actually in Seattle. But really you were in Tennessee. So it's the worst possible source. And I'm really sorry about that.
Well, you must have done something right, because when I arrived here in Eugene at my friend Beth and Walter's house, that's where I am right now. I'm kind of walking around their living room as we're having this conversation. When I arrived back, I had just driven 10 and a half hours across the Cascade Mountains in the dark, and it was kind of starting to snow. Yeah, I'd already like had like, yeah, I was listening to Helter Skelter. I had already done like 5 hours of work that morning before I started driving. I mean, I was so exhausted and so tired of being on the road. Then I walk into Beth and Walter's house, and there's this package on the bed that I'm staying. And I'm like, whoa, what is this? And I kind of deduced based on the address that it might have been a gift from Close Readers. And so I got a beautiful, beautiful Anna Karenina hardbound with this lovely inscription, a folio diary, a bunch of, maybe the best thing was all these notes that everybody wrote.
Right.
They were just so wonderful. And apparently I think there's a bottle of bourbon waiting for me in Seattle. That's what I got. What did you guys get? I cannot tell you. It was so terrific to receive that stuff. And the timing could not possibly have been better. I was so tired and just kind of blew, and I walked into all these lovely gifts.
Yeah, it was pretty. So they presented our gifts during the party here at the office, and we were just like,
completely blindsided me, and then they filmed me being blindsided. And so I'm going to say this on the air because they were watching us. They were watching the video while this was happening, right? And I knew that they were. So I was forcing myself in that moment to stay in front of the camera. But I just want y'all to know I took one for the team, Close Readers, because what I really wanted to do was run and find Karen Kern and just fall into her arms and weep with gratitude privately off camera. But I didn't do it. So instead, when you see me all acting uncomfortable in my own body, like I don't know what to do with myself, that was why.
Yeah.
So Angelina, what did you get?
Oh, I got a gorgeous folio edition of Grimm's Fairy Tales. It's just absurdly beautiful. And it had the most magical inscription that just left me completely speechless. And I got a folio diary also and a bottle of Malbec and the most just heartfelt, perceptive, thoughtful messages, and touched me so very, very deeply. And guys, just thank y'all so much. You have no idea.
Well, like I said, I think I said this after we opened the gifts, and I've said it before. Like if you see the Patreon video, I posted this on Facebook. I don't know if you guys saw. I said when I asked you guys if you wanted to be on the show, you were both like, "What's a podcast?"
Yeah, exactly.
You might have been joking. I don't really know.
No, but I was not joking. My children had to explain to me what a podcast was.
And so basically, my sell was, let's just talk about books and see if someone listens. Great. And so you guys were like, okay. So we started doing it, and you know, it's been a kind of a slow burn. I mean, this is not a podcast that has. It does fine for us, right? But it's not like the kind of podcast that's blowing the ratings out of the water or anything. It's not going to show up on the, you know, on the iTunes charts. And like, at first I was kind of like, well, let's just see what happens. And then I started wondering, oh, it's going to start growing and doing pretty well. And then I realized that it's kind of like, it doesn't need to be the kind of show that is like, you know, like some giant NPR show or like,
right.
One of
This
those
American
shows,
Life.
This American Life or what's the show that everyone was listening to? Serial. It doesn't need to be
Serial,
like
right.
But because like the community that's built around it, if it just grows steadily and slowly and it's just like close and tight knit and we have good conversations, like that's all it needs to be. And so, but then I was shocked by just how many people were really contributing and being a part of the community. And like the Facebook group sort of was the instigator for that. Like Graham and I thought, well, let's just get this Facebook group going because people obviously like talking about books and we'll see what happens. And then it just became something entirely like the amount of people who are on there every day posting like 60 times a day, like Jesse Brown posting 60 times a day. I mean, Jesse, do you not have anything better to do with your life? I'm just
no, David, she does not. What kind of question is that?
I'm just teasing.
She's been stalking me faithfully for years now. It's finally paid off for me.
She was one of the ringleaders behind this whole thing. So I'm going to do something here. Well, Tim, I'll answer your question. They gave me two folio copies of John le Carré books, The Spy Who Came in from the Cold,
Ooh.
Tinker Tailor, which, as you know, are two of my favorite books. So those were, that was pretty exciting.
And then Graham got something. Graham got a folio of The Hobbit.
He did. Yeah. Yeah.
And alcohol. Everyone got alcohol.
Right. Yeah. Yes. 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 So actually Brandon sends me, Brandon LeBlanc, shout out to Brandon. We talk regularly because he helps us with some stuff here at Cersei. So we talk every week at least. And so he sends me this random text one day. It's like, do you like this certain brand of whiskey or whatever? He's like, I think it's near you. Do you know anything about that town? And actually that might've been what he said. He said, do you know anything about this town? And I said, I think it's however far away and it's very small and all that. And he's like, yeah, I think that's where Deviant Whiskey is. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. He's like, is that any good? I was like, I don't know.
Now I think that is good. Brandon, well done.
So, I thought he just wanted geographical information, but maybe he was thinking about parking a food truck there or something.
Right.
But so I didn't think anything of it. And then that's what was in my bag was that whiskey. So
what's so funny to me is listening to them now tell the story of how they pulled this off and how you and Tim were so difficult to figure out, but no one had any trouble knowing exactly what I might want. Just in Malbec over that Facebook page.
So before we get into the book, I'm going to do something a little, for people who don't like banter, they're going to hate this, but this is what I'm going to do.
They're in the wrong show if they don't like banter. Sure. I'm just going to say it.
But the people who did this sent us some notes also. And in that note, it had a list of names. So these are the people that we need to thank. And I'm going to say their names publicly right now on the show.
Yes.
So it's going to take a minute. So just bear with me. But thank
you. Some of those people were my students and I was all undone.
Oh, that is nice. Yeah, I didn't know that. Okay, so thank you to Tim. Why don't you give us a drum roll?
Bing.
Well done.
Wow.
Okay, thank you to, I'm just going to say first names because otherwise it'll take forever. To Amy and Andrea and Angela and Angela and Anna and April and Beth and Bonnie and Bonnie and Brandon and Brandon and Brittany and Cassie and Cassie and Chandra and Chris and Christine. And if I say your name wrong, I apologize. And Dara and Helen and David and Axon. I think I got that right. And Dawn and Diane and Diana and Elizabeth and Fern and Hannah and Jamie and Jana and Gina or Gianna. And then Jennifer and Jennifer and Jessica and Jessica and Jill and John and Jonathan and Karen and Carla and Catherine and Catherine and Katie and Katie and Andy and Kelly and Kelly and Kelly and Kelly. And well, there's a lot of Kellys and Kelly and Carrie.
And we love all of you.
Equally. And Kim and Kimberly and Laura and Laura and Lori and Leanne and Leela or Layla and Leslie and Mary and Mary and Mary Jo and Melanie and Melinda and Melissa and Melissa and Mike and Eliza and Molly and Maria and Nicole and Pamela and Rachel and Renee and Rudy and Susan and Ruth and Sarah and Shanna and Sue and Susan and Susan and Tara and Tawny and the Donnelly family. So thank you to all of you who contributed to that really special gift. I wanted to just give you a shout out. And some of you, I probably know you and may have just said your name wrong, but I wasn't looking at last names. I was just reading first names. So I apologize if I did. Okay, but we are actually here to talk about Twelfth Night, Act 4. So why don't we go ahead and do that? Act 4.
Problem is, act.
Is the problem act.
He solved this problem act by just being 30-second interlude.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's
right.
It's very, very short.
He's like, problem act, I just won't write you.
Yeah. Yeah, so last week we talked about how typically act four for Shakespeare is a problem act because everything has been set up and everything is poised toward a climax and a resolution, but then comes an interlude, act four. I mentioned Hamlet is like the unperformed act in almost every production you've ever seen. They never produce it. But this one was different for me. This one, it actually... Everything, he actually aligned things a little bit further with the relationship between Sebastian and Olivia.
Mm-hmm. And brings out some very important thematic stuff in scene two with Malvolio. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's short,
it's short and it, what am I trying to say? It doesn't feel like he just prolonged act three and it doesn't feel like he's stalling to Act Five. I mean, it works. It's well done.
Yes.
Let's talk about.
And we don't mean when we say that it's a problem act that it's a problem for Shakespeare, right? It's a problem of the form. It's a challenge that Shakespeare has to constantly overcome.
Yeah.
So maybe the thing is he solved it for this play.
It's worth mentioning, of course, that, you know, Shakespeare is doing all of Shakespeare's plays follow the same form, right? And we mentioned that last week, but he's violating a lot of Renaissance forms and is doing something very different than, say, Ben Jonson, who's going with the more classical Aristotelian form for plays. Shakespeare violates all of that, does his own thing all the time, you know. So it has to be in real time, right? So the action has to take place in 2 hours or whatever, not 2 months or, you know, 3 months or, you know, you have to deal with real time. It has to be in one place. And so Shakespeare flips back and forth and he's messing with time and he's got lots of locations and he's not following any of Aristotle's unities, but I'm sure Tim has a lot more to say about that.
Well, can one of you at least break that down a little bit for people who aren't as familiar with the classical forms and what Ben Jonson was imitating in those Aristotelian forms that you're talking about?
Angelina, I actually think you're better on this than I am.
Oh, really? I think I might have just said everything I actually know, and I was hoping I could just hand it off to you.
I mean, can you give a couple of bullet points on what was Ben Jonson doing? What were what were some of those forms that Shakespeare was not?
Well, the unities that I'm talking about for time and place in particular,
which probably come from. Not probably. They come from Aristotle.
Yes. The Aristotle's unities for form. So the play has to take place in real time for Ben Jonson, right? So if the play lasts 2 hours, you are watching 2 hours of action.
And Shakespeare was saying that doesn't matter.
Shakespeare would be like, and then the next day, and then the next month, and a month later, right? And same thing with the geography of it. So what you're seeing on the stage is one location, but Shakespeare is going to go to different countries. Even he's going to flip back and forth from Scotland to England to France. You know, he's all over the globe. He's all over time. Ben Jonson did not like that, of course. And this is why Shakespeare fell out of favor, right? Because after the Renaissance, you have the neoclassical movement. They were all about Ben Jonson. For them, Shakespeare was not interesting because he violated the form. And so they were not interested in Shakespeare's imagination or what he was doing or the innovations. They just saw him as someone who failed because he did not keep Aristotle's forms.
But of course, he was still working within a form.
And absolutely. You
know, he had his own, I don't know if you want to say he invented.
I mean, I think what Shakespeare does that's so great is that he kind of takes, I think he gives us the fullness of the form by turning it into something essentially Christian, you know, with the five act play and then the structure that it follows. And so I think he's far more interesting than someone like Ben Jonson. But I mean, Ben Jonson was huge in his day. I mean, the Elizabethan period was insane for talent, just ridiculous. I remember one of my Shakespeare professors saying that if Shakespeare had not lived during the Renaissance, I mean, you would have 10 plays that everybody would be talking about as the great Elizabethan poets and playwrights, I mean, because they were just extraordinary. You had Marlowe and Jonson and all those guys, but Shakespeare eclipses them all because he was just insane, right? Insanely talented. But that's to give you some perspective. Like, he's the best at a time that was the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's because he was seven people.
You know what, David? Can I take that up a little bit? The theory is that Shakespeare wasn't theory. That Shakespeare wasn't Shakespeare. Francis Bacon.
There was more. Well, there's a lot of different theories on it, right? Like, it could. There were theories that there's four or five different theories on whether it's one specific person, and then there's that it's a whole troop of people that were writing his plays, and that there may have been one person named William Shakespeare, but he was only just a part of this crew of Shakespeare of playwrights.
Right.
Or it was a pseudonym.
I find that really hard to believe. It's a fun thing that, you know, students can kind of sink their teeth into Shakespeare by saying, oh, but was there really a Shakespeare behind Shakespeare? Was it Francis Bacon or somebody like that?
Yeah, I love that.
And the question is, that sometimes comes up because they say, oh, Shakespeare didn't really have an access to the sort of education that he would have needed to have in order to write the sorts of plays with their knowledge of Latin and of history and of flora and fauna and battles. And that's just ignorant. I don't know any other way to say it. Like Shakespeare's education was like, it was incredible. He had, and you know what? He had kind of a classical Christian education. If I can plug Circe a little bit, I mean, that's probably what it most resembled. It certainly resembled that much more than it resembled like a modern public education. He didn't have anything like that, which thank God, because now we would have not had a Shakespeare if he had attended the public high school of modern America. I'm so down. I'm rabbit trailing here. I just taught my last class of the day for my classical students with Scholae Academy. I had a student just ask, okay, what did she ask me? Gracie is going to get a shout out. She said,
I hope
Mr. Mack, oh, it's awesome. Mr. Mack, is the opposite of DK chaos or injustice? And I was like, I turned to my friend Walter and I was like, can you believe a high school student is asking me that question? It was just so... And that question just doesn't get asked in public high school. I've taught public high school. I'm really ripping public high school, but I just believe in a different form of education. Shakespeare had something much more like that form of education.
But what's interesting is just how much this theory or this series of theories has actually sort of taken hold of the like literary world's imagination over the last 100 years, because there are many, many books written about this topic.
Right.
I had to write a paper on it. I had to write a thesis on it in college. And, you know, there's no shortage of books. So if you're interested in finding some of these theories, there are even books about all the theories and saying which one they think is right. So let alone each.
Could I give my, I think there are two reasons why the theory is plausible. Number one is the sheer, incredible, prodigious output of genius. 37 plays. Some of them are not as good as Hamlet and Macbeth and Twelfth Night, but 35 of them are, you know, 33 of them are. They're just like unrivaled works of genius. And to think like that one man generated all of these works, that's just a really tough thing to accept. But it's acceptable, but it's just tough to accept. The other thing, and I think this actually probably did happen, is that Shakespeare didn't work alone. He was part of a troupe. The troupe changed it. So it was, the equivalent today would be, what do they call it? A repertory theater. In a repertory theater, you have core members who are actors, and the theater selects plays that conform to the casting capabilities of the repertory theater, of the troupe. Shakespeare had that. You know, the number of people swelled sometimes, the number decreased sometimes, but he had one main actor that played virtually all of his lead roles. Angelina, his name is escaping me. Richard Burbage.
Yes, that's it. That's it.
Widely accepted as one of the great actors in the history of England, if not the history of Europe. He played Hamlet in Macbeth, and I don't know what he would have played in this. Maybe he would have played Orsino in Twelfth Night. But Shakespeare wrote for these guys, and I can't help but think that they contributed a lot to the final form of the play. You know, these are tremendously eloquent men. Of course, there are no women in the troupe. Tremendously eloquent men. They surely had some poetic gifting because they're always performing incredible poetic works. And my thought is, you know what? They probably helped sand and shape some of the scenes that we now have in our Shakespeare collected works.
Wait, was that the end? I'm waiting. Is that the end? Did you just take a bow? Are you finished?
I just took a bow a flourish.
I really hope there was a flourish. Yeah. So here's my two cents on this, right? I'm going to give you the weirdo Angelina response. Ready?
Which I know y'all have come to. Is it really going to be 5 cents?
Nice, David. Nice. I can count. Okay, so here's my weird Angelina answer, which I know we've all come to expect the weird Angelina answer. Who cares? Like, who seriously cares, right? For me, Shakespeare is the man that I encounter in the plays. That is the voice I hear. That is the imagination I'm exposed to. Like, I don't understand this obsession with knowing who he actually was historically. It seems like such a modern obsession. The whole idea of the author and his relationship to the work and all that, such a modern idea. Works have been anonymous for a long time because that just, it was the work that was the thing, right? Not the person. And well, and Tolkien even warned about being overly biographically obsessed. So,
yeah, yeah.
So I'm saying that it's not like, you can do it, right? You can pursue that scholarly thing. I don't think it changes how I read these plays. I don't think it changes what these plays mean to me or to the world or to the canon or anything, right?
Yeah, the voice
that I hear as I read these plays is the same voice. It is a consistent voice. I'm not like being jolted around like, wow, how did he, now he's playing jazz. Now, you know, it's not like that, right? I mean, I hear a consistent voice and a consistent imagination through all of these plays, you know, whoever this man is. Then, you know, and so I just don't get obsessed with this question because it doesn't change what these plays mean to me. And it kind of reminds me of a joke I like to tell my students all the time because there's also controversy, you know, over Homer. And did Homer really exist? And who is Homer? And he could not have possibly written all of this. You know, it's the same thing. And the joke that goes around is, no, you're right. Homer did not write the Iliad and the Odyssey. It was another blind poet named Homer. It's just a way of saying it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with that. But I think the reason that it's, you know, I mean, people enjoy biographies, right? So like people just like to know about Charles Dickens or something. Like if you love Charles Dickens or you love Wendell Berry or you love whoever, then people are interested in that person. So then it just becomes a whole, you know, people are just interested in it. I don't think it changes how you read the plays, but just if people are interested in that sort of thing, then it's an interesting, you know, rabbit trail to go down, so to speak. But I think you're totally right that I don't think there's any reason to start pursuing different avenues or angles of reading the plays or to start thinking that he's trying to do something different than what he was doing or that the plays exist in some other plane because of based on who the authors were or whatever.
Right.
And some of these scholarly theories will try to make the plays be political based on who they think wrote them. And Shakespeare's not political, not in that sense.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, that gets me concerned too. Like, don't start looking for, oh, well, Henry V is really supposed to be this guy and modern Elizabethan politics and blah, blah, blah. You know, like, no, that's not what's going on here.
Yeah. It kind of effaces the work in the kind of biographical quest. And I agree with you. I'm curious about Shakespeare's identity for the reason that David mentioned, like,
it's
the same reasons I'm curious about. It's absolutely secondary, but I'm just curious about, like, what Shakespeare the man was like, just like I'm curious what Wendell Berry the man is like. And for that reason, I think it's an interesting conversation to have. But Angelina is exactly right. The concerns in the canon, Shakespeare's canon, are so similar. And that you can see this kind of, for me at least, I see a single author because the concerns are so... Oh, they're so consistent from the earliest plays to the latest plays. They're not all the same, but he really shares the same. He's kind of obsessing over the same sorts of questions.
Yeah.
Oh,
I would even argue he might be. I think there's one question he's obsessed about more than any other, and it's unfortunately not in Twelfth Night. It's kingly power and the abuse of kingly power. Or at least like an ultimate authority. So maybe the Tempest doesn't have a king in it, but you do have one person who is in charge of this entire island.
But he is
obsessed with that question. And boy, living in his time, it makes a lot of sense why he might be interested in that question.
Now that's really interesting because I also think that Shakespeare has a single obsession. And I was like, he's not going to say what I'm thinking. But you did, but you may use different words than I would have done. I'm agreeing with you though, but I'm just putting a different spin on it. I think that Shakespeare is obsessed with order, and that order is rooted in the king.
Yeah.
And then he just shows what happens when there's disorder. And the king himself can be disordered, of course, or there can be an attack on the king, but everything starts to unravel. So things are centered. His idea of order very centered around that idea of kingly authority. Well, so yeah, I completely
agree. And of course, that does that. If you put it that way, it does show up at Twelfth Night.
Yes, the order idea does.
Even a comedy like Measure for Measure, I mean, it's basically the beginning. The beginning of Measure for Measure is it? I think it's the governor of the town is leaving, and he leaves his right-hand man in charge, but he's actually not leaving. He's actually going undercover because he wants to see how his town is actually running. So he kind of, I think he dresses up as a priest, as a traveling priest or something like that.
Yes.
And so kind of like he willingly removes himself from the throne so that he can see just how orderly his kingdom is after all. And of course, it kind of starts to really fall apart, and everything starts to get abused when he's gone. And then he unmasks himself, just like we've talked about in so many other Shakespeare plays. He unmasks himself, takes off his disguise, his true self is there, and everything is restored to order once he does that.
Mm-hmm. Always. Even in the tragedies, there's a movement from chaos to order, always.
Yeah.
In Twelfth Night, though, while it's not a strong motif, I did underline a single line in this Act Four that I thought was a nod to what we're talking about. And that's where Sir Andrew says, "If there be any law in Illyria." And I thought that was an interesting nod to connecting the order and the chaos that they're experiencing with the question of, is there law in this place?
Well, and it seems like, so at the end of Act Three, we talked about how it kind of built to this climactic moment where, there's like very real chaos going on. And so how does it all get unraveled? And it starts to get unraveled here in Act Four in some ways, even as it gets more complicated, which is an interesting, accomplishment for Shakespeare.
To get unraveled, David. Say more. Yeah.
I think he means the tangle of the plot begins to unravel a little bit.
Right.
We don't see that movement of Olivia and Sebastian getting betrothed. That is a movement toward what's going to be the resolution,
right.
But it is in and of itself the resolution.
Right. That's what I meant. Like,
it's still an act of confusion. So yeah,
movement.
Yeah. So Act Four ends up being brilliant in that one moment when Olivia and Sebastian become betrothed, it is an act of confusion. It is an act of mistaken identity, and yet it is going to be the thing that will bring back the clarity and unravel it.
I was going to ask you guys about that because I think that's the sort of scene that a lot of people have trouble with in certain Shakespeare plays. Like, they're just kind of roll their eyes at it because all of a sudden Sebastian just decides, oh, I'm in love with this person, right?
But that's how everybody's been acting in this play. This is completely consistent.
Right, exactly. But that's one of the things that, people who are used to a novel, for example, where I just interviewed Dr. Benedict Whalen from Hillsdale, and I was just mentioning this before we recorded, and people may have already listened to that interview, but he talks about how there is a scholar who refers to this scene as the husband ex machina.
Great.
I love it. And he was talking about how it is sort of consistent with what's been going on, and it also reveals just the extent to which Viola is different than everybody else, including her brother. Like, because of her steadiness and her constancy, and everyone else is just so wishy-washy. And so it begins, even though she's not on the stage, it reveals a lot about her. And Olivia is like the opposite of her. She just sees, Sebastian is like the opposite. He's like, okay, whatever, right now. But do you guys see this as a problem in experiencing Shakespeare? Like, it just feels like it happens.
All right, okay. I'm going to get up on my soapbox for this. Can I get up on my soapbox?
I would expect nothing less.
Okay, so here's my soapbox. This is what I'm always telling my students. You must let the form dictate the rules of how you read, right? And And a Shakespeare comedy has forms, right? Nobody in a Shakespeare comedy is slowly falling in love. Everybody's having a moment where they're knocked upside the head and fall in love. This is how these things work, right? Because it's always about the sudden revelation. That's thematically what is happening. And in this play, of course, we have the topsy-turvy thing, right? So everybody is going to fall in love very quickly here. And then it's a madness of emotion, as we've said before. And then, but there's going to be one character in the midst of this tornado of mad emotions who's going to be constant and steadfast. And that's Viola, right? She is the steadfast, unmovable character from the very first time we meet her to the end of this play. She loves one person and one person only. And everybody else is, they're just emotions are everywhere. And like wherever they look, that's just where they fall in love. And that's the nature of this play. And if you're expecting them to act like rational, slow, well, if you expect Sebastian in Act 4 to be like, I think you're cute, I don't actually know who you are, and you're probably having me mistaken for someone else, so let's get a coffee and get to know each other, then you don't know what play you're in.
No, that's... I agree with that, but it's a different question than I think what I'm kind of suggesting.
Okay, so what is the question that you're asking? Because I heard you asking... tell me what you're asking.
I'm most likely I asked it wrong. So I completely agree that you have to allow the form to dictate your experience, at least, I mean, you're going to experience it how you experience it, but your understanding of it, your approach to it. But what I'm saying is that the form itself is the kind of thing that people roll their eyes at. Like that it is the kind of form or the kind of world or the kind of story that such a thing would happen is something that people just, you know, think is ridiculous. And is that just a modern way of looking at things? Would that be your fallback answer on that? So it's not that
probably some version of that would be my follow-up. I mean, this play has this play, like most Shakespeare comedies, has a fairy element to it. And I even underlined, and I wanted to bring this up. So we'll probably bring this up later because I want to really explore this because Sebastian has a couple of lines that I think readers are going to take as a throwaway line, but are really essential to understanding this madcap fairyland. And he says, "Am I asleep? Is this a dream?" And then he says, "If I'm dreaming, I hope I stay asleep." That's what happens in the fairyland. It is a dream, and you are in a dreamlike state, and people are acting the way that they act in dreams, right? Time is compressed. Things happen very quickly. They're nonsensical. They don't make sense. Lots of non sequiturs, right? And so Sebastian's in a dream here. And this is what happens in dreams. You wake up from a dream, and you're madly in love with some person you dreamed about, and there's no good reason for it.
Is the part that you're talking about, Angelina, right after Sebastian has kind of fallen in love? Is that the time that you're?
Yes, right at the end of scene one, act four.
At the end of one. Yeah, okay.
At the end of one, so line 60. What relish is in this? How runs the stream? Or am I mad? So he puts together madness, dreaming, sleep, imagination, and forgetfulness all here, which, by the way, Patreon sponsors, if you listen to my talk about the disguise motif, those are the four things that I said is always true in the Shakespeare plays with the disguise motif, and he puts them all in the same speech here, right? So madness, dreaming, sleeping, awake, forgetfulness, imagination, all of that. He puts it all in these four lines. Am I mad? Oh, no, I'm sorry. Or I am mad, or else this is a dream. Let fancy, which means imagination, still my sense in lethest sleep, which means that's the river of forgetfulness. If it be thus to dream, still let me sleep. Now, this actually, well, what this does is actually flips the motif on its head, because everywhere else, characters begin asleep in a state of forgetfulness, in a dreamlike state, and then they move toward waking up, remembering, and all of that is connected to self-knowledge and the revelation at the end. At the end, their disguise is off, they have woken up, they have remembered, they've cast off the dream. And so Sebastian here is actually saying, I want to stay asleep, I want to not remember, yeah. I want to forget. So he's choosing to stay in the place of you know, not knowing himself, which in scene two, that's going to come up again, because Malvolio will say this madness is this madness of ignorance. It's the hell of ignorance. So you have this idea of self-knowledge as a movement toward the fullness of your humanity, toward movement toward heaven, and ignorance as a movement toward hell and darkness. And so all of that is together in scene two, that Malvolio is in the darkness of hell, and it's the darkness of hell of ignorance. Because the real ignorance here is the issue of self-knowledge. That's the knowledge that they lack, that they don't know who they are. Okay, I'm stepping off my soapbox now.
Well, I'm really glad you brought up the fairy concept, that fairyland or dreamland concept, because Dr. Whalen in that interview, he mentioned one of the, you know, there is a, this poem was, or this play was always kind of understood as to have a festive tone, which is one of the reasons why it was, you know, related to Christmas and all that. But it got me thinking about the idea of like almost, it's, there's this vacation vibe about the whole thing. Like the, or they all got trapped on an island somewhere and they're not really worried about what's going on in the rest of their lives. It's like the comedic survivor or something.
No, that's exactly right. That's one of the points that Harold Goddard makes, is that most of the comedies do have a fairyland element, but at some point they leave it. Right? So they come to this place of self-knowledge and then they leave fairyland and they come back into the real world. Twelfth Night being the exception. They never leave it. They never leave fairyland.
Well, and one, you know, you, I want to ask a question. So after the Sebastian thing here, you mentioned the, you know, he met, she, Sebastian mentions madness, dreaming, imagination, and forgetfulness. And then the next line is, so he says, if it be thus to dream, let me sleep. That seems to harken back to the opening lines from Orsino in a way. The, if music be the food of love. And now I know that thematically they're not the same, but there's even a meter. There's even like a rhythm to the language.
Yeah, David, that's right.
You're right. That's a great observation. No, right on to that. Yeah. And because so music is what stirs up the emotion of melancholy and he wants to stay in that state.
Yep. Okay. So what's really interesting to me is he's like saying, I want to stay in this state. Like he's not even asking, I'll just put it this way, to be free of it. Like he wants to be captured by it. Mm-hmm. And what I love about this is he's like, Shakespeare plays with this idea in the very next line, right? Because Olivia says, nay, come, I prithee. And then she says, would thou'st be ruled by me? And so this, like, basically he's saying he wants to like fall under the spell or be captured or like remain in this forgetful fairyland state. And then she says, do you want to be ruled by me? And so Shakespeare is playing with this idea of like power and being, this idea of like being, you can be captured or enamored by something, but also this other way of looking at that word of like, you know, to be in her spell is also to be under her power, and he's submitting to her power. And so you've got this powerful woman who's basically taking power over this dude, and he's like, yeah, I'll do that. And that in its own way was sort of subversive.
It is subversive, but I also think that there's the bigger idea of submitting to the power of love, because I think that Orsino is also making the same case to Olivia via Cesario, right? Be ruled by this love. How many times are you saying submit to this, submit to his love, submits it, and she won't submit to his love. And here Olivia is saying, you know, you're feeling it. You give in. And he says, yes, ma'am.
Yeah. So, and, but that's the beautiful thing about Shakespeare, is these things mean so many different things and they can be read in so many different ways. And they're always tying back to something else. Like there's, it's another scene.
Twelfth Night, I really feel like, is one of those plays that it can't be the only play that you read of Shakespeare's. That's not as common on the quality of it by any means, but just that he's playing, he's subverting and flipping around so many of the themes and motifs that he really explores in depth in other plays, right? So, you know, Shakespeare does not think that this is a good move to say, I want to stay in a perpetual state of forgetfulness because this feels good. That is not where Shakespeare lands on that question in the other plays.
Right. Well, we'll talk about that specific idea when we go through Act 5 next week. Do we need to talk about Malvolio? I don't mean like, do we need to talk about Malvolio?
Must
we talk about him?
I think we'll talk about him next week, David. Okay.
That's what I was wondering, is do we want to wait till next week? Angelina, do you agree with that? Should we wait and kind of cover the Malvolio subject in Act 5?
Okay, sure. You want to hold on to Scene 2 until next week? That's fine.
We could also set the stage for next week if you want by talking about it now.
Why don't you set the stage, Angelina?
Okay, let's do that. Then because we only have so much time anyway. So go ahead and set the stage for next. It starts off
with more of the disguise motif, right? So the clown is putting on a disguise and says, I will dissemble myself. So, wow, you know, now we're getting hit over the head by Shakespeare with what his theme means, right? That the disguise really means you're going to deceive yourself. And then he has these conversations with Malvolio. And so Malvolio is in this, you know, this dark cell or whatever. He's locked in darkness. And there's a couple of different reasons for that. One, that was the Renaissance. That was a believed Renaissance cure for madness. Go be in the dark by yourself. And I guess you would somehow come to your senses. Maybe they thought it was an overstimulation of the senses. I don't know why they did that, but they did do that. But then, of course, it's got a symbolic meaning. This is Malvolio's descent into hell. I mean, just from an archetypal perspective, somebody goes sitting in a dark cell by themselves. That is definitely hell. But in case we missed it, he says repeatedly, I'm in hell. This darkness is hell. By the way, also, I'm in hell, and it's really dark in hell.
In case you need it to be put to you very specifically and directly.
Right. Yeah.
Malvolio's not one for subtlety.
I'm talking to you, front row, second seat. I'm in hell, just so we're all on the same page. Right. He keeps making that.
Can I ask him a question about that, actually?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Because there's something I wanted to say about that also. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, go for it.
Okay. So, Tim, I want to talk to you about performing this or how you might direct this. And Angelina, hold the rest of your thought because I don't want to go away from that.
No, you're fine. You're fine.
Okay. So line 40 of Act 14-2. This is where Malvolio says, I'm not mad, Sir Topaz. I say to you, this house is dark. And Angelina just mentioned... I think she just mentioned the audience possibly there. So if you were performing or directing this, would you want Malvolio to turn to the audience there? Or would this be something where it'd be specifically to Sir Topaz? Or would you want, is this the kind of line where you'd be trying to bring in the audience into the performance of the play?
David, I'm sorry. Help me find. So he says, I want to find the exact line so I can see it.
It's
line 39 of scene 2.
Yeah, I don't have lines. Give me a string of words.
Malvolio just says, I'm not mad, Sir Topaz.
Go down about 30 lines after Enter Toby.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Malvolio within is in italics there.
This is Act 4, Scene
2.
Two.
Give me a second.
He says,
look for the word Pythagoras.
Yeah.
The clown starts asking math questions.
The opinion of Pythagoras concerning white?
Go about 10 lines above that.
10 lines above that.
I am not mad, Sir Topaz. I say to you, this house is dark. So obviously they've been talking about it, and he's being asked all these questions, and Sir Topaz and Malvolio just keeps bringing up it's dark. Clown says, "Sayest thou that house is dark?" Malvolio says, "As hell, Sir Topaz." Keeps talking, and then I'm not mad, Sir Topaz. I say to you, this house is dark. My question is, would you bring in the audience in that particular?
Would you bring the audience in?
In other words, would you turn and face the audience on that, or would you just turn and talk to Sir Topaz? Is that a possible area you could try?
Ooh.
Or does doing that make it too humorous? Or can you build up the pathos in Malvolio's experiences here by turning to the audience and kind of like bemoaning his situation by saying...
Yeah. Well, I might have him say it to the audience. I think that's a really clever idea. Because he's such a difficult character to have sympathy for, but now he's in chains, now he's in prison, now he's in hell. It might be a moment where you could have him speak to the audience and salvage some amount of sympathy for this character who's just been a buffoon the entire play. I kind of like that idea. I think that... there's a little bit of fun that Shakespeare is having here. He's talking about being in hell. So in Shakespeare's stage, there would have been a trap door in the middle of the stage. And the trap door went down to the cellarage. And the nickname for the cellarage was hell. My hunch is that Malvolio is somehow underneath the stage. Now, I don't know how he would have done that.
Well, you could just hear him yelling.
Well, he's supposed to be in some kind of dungeon.
Yeah. I would bet that he's actually underneath the stage. Now, does that mean that the audience couldn't hear him? Couldn't see him? I doubt they could have seen him, but they probably could have heard him. So as a side note, I keep going back to Hamlet because it's just kind of like the archetypal Shakespeare play. If you remember, when the ghost first appears to Hamlet, he appears... Yes.
Okay. I want to just comment on your, I just noticed something that I think might support your stage, your under the stage thing. So you know how the clown says right above this, it hath bay windows transparent as barricados, and the Clara stories toward the south north are lustrous, as lustrous as ebony, and yet thou complainst of obstruction. Weren't the Clara stories, isn't that, weren't those upper windows? So like you could, if he was underground and the windows that were up high were open, basically you're saying, well, up here it's all, you know, he's basically saying up here on the stage where there's plenty of space to see because the windows up here are all open.
No, I think Tim is exactly right. When you read those lines thinking Malvolio is actually in a dark confined space, then though that whole conversation is hilariously funny,
it's
right?
He's so saying, funny.
The other one's saying, no, it's not. He's looking at, no, it's not. It's plenty of light. Look at all these windows. You must be crazy. I'm not crazy. I'm telling you I'm in the dark. But the fact that he'd be saying this just to a voice under the stage is, that's hilarious.
And thematically brilliant. That we could have seen the clown above the stage. He's perfectly visible. He's describing, perhaps you're right, David, clear stores. Perhaps he's describing the actual structure of Shakespeare's play, and to have Malvolio be saying from beneath the stage, I'm not mad, Sir Topas. I say to you, this house is dark. You know, like, I'm really blind down here. I think the audience would have loved that.
And then the clown say, yeah, but look at here.
But ignorance.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, I just didn't want to run. I wanted to mention that before we.
Yes.
So, okay, go on and talk about what you.
Well, Hamlet's father, when he first appears to Hamlet, he's visible to all of us. And then Hamlet kind of makes this long, beautiful oath to revenge his father. And then Hamlet's two buddies show up after he's sworn his oath. And Hamlet's father says, we hear his voice swear, and it sounds like he's trying to get Hamlet's buddies to swear to an oath to not tell anybody what Hamlet has seen. And there's either a stage direction. No, it's one of Hamlet's lines. He says something to the effect of that voice is coming from down there, which would have been really powerful because Hamlet's father was confined in hell for a certain time, and he freed to walk the earth for a certain time. But it seems like his soul is in hell because he died in sin. He died before he could confess. So anyway, that's another example of Shakespeare. That's a hard thing to read if you're not looking at Shakespeare's actual play with an actual trapdoor and with actors who could be heard.
You've mentioned this to me before. This would be something that would be missing from a modern staging of it as well, right? If you just had the black box kind of set up, you wouldn't have a sense that he was really under the stage in hell.
Right. The version that I have watched before, the Kenneth Branagh version, they build a little kind of sloped prison into the stage. But he's on top of the stage. He's just in a prison. He's not below the stage.
I'm so fascinated by this idea of him being under the stage, which interestingly would make him on the same level as the audience.
Yeah.
And him being under the stage, but you can't see him, but you can just hear his voice. And like the actor would have to project. But I mean, that must have been hilarious.
It must have been so funny.
And then I love how you get this transition where they start talking about Pythagoras and wildfowl. And it just gets random. It's because he's trying to prove he's not mad.
But yes. Then
Malvolio Angelina says, make the trial of it in any constant question. And here's that idea of constancy again that you talked about in the first few acts. So what do you think is the purpose or effect or use of the specific question about Pythagoras concerning wildfowl?
Oh.
Do you think is it just Shakespeare being funny?
My note says this refers to the Pythagorean doctrine of the transmigration of souls. So I don't know.
Yeah, mine does.
That's why he responds, the soul of Grandam might happily inhabit a bird. Yes, I'm going to have to just say I don't know what all that means.
Well, and then the clown says, what thinkest thou of this, of his opinion? And then Malvolio says, well, I think nobly of the soul and no way approve of his opinion. So like,
he gets very, very comedy. Remain in the darkness. So it has something to do
serious.
with, knowledge and ignorance again, right?
Yes. Yeah.
The only other thing I wanted to say about scene two in Malvolio, his constant saying, this house is in the dark. This house is a darkness, is that we have had two houses, you know, again, Shakespeare, I mean, just, you know, my baby, my love in literature is structure. That's my baby. And part of the reason I'm madly in love with Shakespeare is because of the structure, what he does with the structure, and everything is so balanced and in perfect harmony with one another. And we've talked about how all of these characters are doubles and pairs, and they're all being set off in contrast. And so essentially the action of this play involves two houses, right? The house of Orsino and the house of Olivia. And we've literally been going back and forth between these houses, and he's been showing us over and over, it's the same house. It's the same house. It's really the same house. And the even the fact that the clown goes back and forth and Viola goes back and forth. Those are the two characters that have any sense at all, the clown and Viola, and they are of neither house and they go back and forth between the houses. And so when Malvolio is imprisoned in this dark house and he says, this house is dark, he's saying that those houses are dark. All of the houses are dark. Olivia's house is dark. Orsino's house is dark. And it's the darkness of ignorance. There's no self-knowledge in those houses.
Tim, if Shakespeare had been performing, well, I mean, he obviously was, but when they were performing the play, how would they have done these two houses on the stage in the 1600s and or late 1500s or whatever? Would it have been would they have been two different houses and on opposite sides of the stage, and they would have actually kind of used each half of the stage to represent where those houses were? Or would they have done the whole like high school theater thing where you move different sets on and off? Or would they have been very generic? How would they have done that? Do you know?
I don't know, except for I'm pretty confident they didn't move sets on. I think they probably solved it by having one side of the stage be one house, one side of the stage be the other house. But as far as like how much they built their stages out to kind of, I just don't think that they dressed their sets. Oh gosh, I'm not being very clear.
Well, so they would have just kind of kept it minimal.
Hunch is they would have kept it minimal. Now, this because the stage would have been relatively fixed. You know, there would have been hell below the stage. There would have been kind of a painting of the cosmos above the stage, but I don't think they would have had bulky fixtures, a lot of bulky fixtures, because the scenes are changing from place to place so rapidly. They just didn't have time for that.
Where was the trap door? Would that have been in the middle?
I think it would have been in the middle.
Well, see, then that totally supports the idea then. Malvolio is also in the middle of these two houses saying, this house is dark, this house is dark.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost, there's almost like a no man's land aspect to it.
Yes. Yeah, there is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the issue also is that they're probably performing multiple different plays. They at least had the capability of performing multiple different plays on successive nights, which, let's just stop and think about that. Memorizing a Shakespeare play is so monstrously challenging. And these lovely actors probably had 15 full plays, if not more, in their head at a time that they could perform on successive nights. It's bewildering to somebody who lives in the digital age where our memories are just not, at least we don't think they're as valuable as we used to
believe. They're certainly not as exercised.
They're definitely not as exercised. And they had the capacity to perform a different play every night. And my hunch is that they could memorize at a speed that to me is unfathomable.
Well, and you know, it wasn't like they were able to get print copies of things. So the memories, like I said, they were exercised in a different way. So that muscle was probably in pretty good shape. So there was a culture of having, strong memory muscles, so to speak.
You know, I never thought of this before, but I bet the extremely predictable pattern of a Shakespeare play would have really aided them in their ability to memorize
his
part and always know where they are in the story.
I bet you're right.
And of course, the language for them wasn't. It was their language. I mean, it was dressed. Yes. It was played with.
I mean, it's poetry, though. Nobody really spoke like that.
No. You're right. But there's at least it was more like the way they spoke than the way they spoke.
Yes.
So
first, can I mention a pro tip for one word? As if people want to try to read Shakespeare, you know, in a class or around their dinner table in their living room, there's a word that everybody reads that I have always read in a certain way that's probably not the way that we read it. And that's the word O, just the letter O. That's probably not O-H. It's probably an exhalation of emotion. So it's, you know, like when you read Shakespeare, you read, oh, my brains are bewildered by such, you know, but it's probably, my brains are so bewildered. It's
last almost line on 4.1.
The last line on 4.1, is there an O?
Yeah. O say so and so be. Olivia, right, is the exit.
So she says, wouldst thou be ruled by me?
Yes,
and
there it is.
Sebastian says, madam, I will. And so then you're saying she's exhaling some sort of emotion.
Yes.
Say
oh,
so.
Yes, she is. Sebastian just said he's in.
He did. He just said he's in.
So you're saying he didn't just confess that he wanted to be in, and then she was like, oh, say so and so be. Oh, say so.
David, you fit women so well.
I know. I really.
That's just how we are.
I know.
Oh, wait, you want to marry me? Oh, okay.
And that's such an opportunity for actors. Like, what does that emotion, that just sort of like primal emotional sound like? If it doesn't sound like, oh, say so and so be, what would it sound like? Which is kind of funny. My Shakespeare teachers used to really get frustrated with me because I kept defaulting into saying, oh, say so and so be. And Sparky Roberts would just be like, Tim, it's not. Oh, it's an exhalation of emotion. But that's, I don't know, that was a little bit of a challenge for me. Because I don't know, raw showing of emotion is not the like Southern pastor's kid's way.
But also like, oh, say so and so be. There's like, it's, you can memorize that. You can't memorize
an exhalation of emotion. Yeah.
You have to internalize it and then externalize it. Like it has to become a part of your interpretation and your characterization of the scene. Like it's got to be so much more than just the letter or the word that's in your head. It becomes
absolutely.
Then that's much more challenging.
I love that. I'm so glad you said that because now I'm thinking Olivia has been chasing this man for four acts. Clearly, she thinks it's the same man.
Yeah,
and he's finally said yes. So you better believe there's an exhalation of emotion coming out of there. What?
Absolutely right. There's so many. It's so fun to go back and read Shakespeare plays that you know well and just search for those O's because they're just such fun opportunities for the actor. I mean, again, Hamlet, his first soliloquy begins with a big O. Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. So what does that O mean at the beginning of that soliloquy? That's a fun decision to make. It's a fun emotional outpouring to convey.
Well, and if you look at the end of Three, you know, the scene where Viola, Antonio thinks Viola is like abandoning him and is ignoring him, because you get Antonio saying, but oh, how vile and idle proves this God. And you can sense, if you think about it that way, you can sense this like the opposite of what Olivia is feeling, right?
Viola's literal last sentence in Act Three is an O. And so then that flips around to Olivia's O, and it's going to be two very different O's because she's saying, oh, you don't love me.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah. So at the end of Three, so Antonio says, but oh, how vile and idle proves this God. So there's anger in that one. And then a few lines later, Viola says, but prove true imagination. Oh, prove true. So there's like longing in that one.
Yes.
Yeah. And her last line is, oh, if it proved tempests are kind and salt waves fresh in love. And then she exits.
Yeah. Yeah. So when I was talking to Benedict Whalen, he said that one of the things he runs into sometimes is he'll have a couple students read a line or whatever, or they'll be talking about what they'll be talking about is, say, Hamlet's soliloquy. And one student will say, it seems like he's really angry here. And then another student will say, it seems like he's really sad here. So then what he'll do is he'll say, okay, you think he's angry, read it as if he's angry. And then he'll turn to the, and then that kid will do that. And then he'll turn to the other student and say, you think he's sad. So why don't you read it as if he's sad? And so when they do that, they have to interpret each line, each word, according to that lens that they felt at how they first felt about it. And then that opens up all kinds of conversation about what Shakespeare is doing with the language.
Love that.
And so, you know, you don't have to read, you can read, they can even read like four or five words, you know, and still be able to get at that. And it's really interesting to think about how he, you know, a little word like that can affect so much of how you interpret, you know, a soliloquy or a series of lines. So in, you know, that, in Hamlet could be anger, or it could be sadness, it could be frustration, it could be disorientation, it could be, you know, any number of things.
Yeah.
And it can, that's the thing about Shakespeare, is one word, one letter in this case, can mean so much.
Yeah.
That's not true of just anybody.
Yes. And again, for me, it's because he is giving an opportunity to actors. That O, that standalone letter, doesn't really mean anything aside from the emotional context that surrounds it. And so he's giving the opportunity for the actor to just respond with his body, and like just kind of like convey in a volcanic sort of fashion what that emotion is.
It also seems like he's giving him some freedom to kind of play with it.
Yes,
to try things. Go ahead.
So this is a legitimate question. So, you know, as y'all are talking, I'm thinking to myself, but Shakespeare wrote these parts for specific people that he knew very well. Obviously there's a lot of trust there, and he could, you know, write for certain people knowing what they could give to the role. Right.
Right.
And so before the show started, before we started recording, we were talking about, you know, that Shakespeare never wanted these published in his own lifetime, which that raises the question to me, did he ever want some other troupe to perform these, or were these really written for specific people? And, you know, he knows how Richard Burbage is going to deliver that line, right? But he doesn't know how some other guy 200 years later is going to deliver the line 400 years later, 500 years later. If he did not want them published, which he did not, it was all done after his death, the actors put it together, but so what does that mean? Did he not want, or did it just not occur to him that other troops would put this? I mean, obviously at the time people were putting on ripped off editions of Shakespeare, right? I mean, our listeners might not know that, but people would sit in the audience and furiously scribble down everything that was being said and watch it over and over and get it as close as they could, and then they'd go put on a knockoff Hamlet where, you know, it was a third of the lines and it was a big mismatch mess. And so obviously Shakespeare wants to protect it. I'm sure that was part of the reasons why he did not publish things, because he's trying to maintain control over his own work. But
yeah, I think Ben Jonson was very, like, he had the total control over the publication of his work. And so I think that it's probably just a lot of work, and it's very expensive. Like, Ben Jonson paid to have his works published and bound and all that kind of stuff. That's a great question, though. That's a great question.
You know, David, I don't know. Well, Angelina, also, when we're saying Shakespeare didn't want these published, do we mean that he opposed their publishing, or that he did not write them with the expectation that that they were going to be published? What do we mean by that?
That's a good question, because there's so much scholarship devoted to this, and I don't even know if we even agree with what we mean, right? I guess we can all agree he didn't physically go do it. He didn't
agree.
Well, and he didn't expect it to be done. Like, it wasn't, he didn't write it with that purpose in mind.
That he can even say that. I mean, his friends did it. So how do we know that there wasn't
I guess I just thought that I've read from experts that he didn't expect it. Like, it was never an intention to have them printed. And I don't know. I can't remember. I don't know if it was because of the finances of it or he just wasn't interested. Right. I can't really answer the question.
Well, that raises in my mind the second question, though. I mean, why would a playwright not want actors to put on his play after he's dead? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's my question also. Right? Like, well, is it that kind of the point of why you write a play? You want it to be performed.
Well, and of course, he did get pretty rich off them during mm-hmm. his lifetime. But maybe it wasn't so much that he didn't want them performed so much as he... I mean, I don't know. I don't know the answer, but I'm just... Maybe it's just that it's a different thing to have them continue to be performed by professionals as
but
opposed
you
to
have
just,
a like, script. But you have to have a script. Well, got to exist in some kind of way for them to continue to put it on.
Well, they existed during his life, is my understanding. Like, he gave the actors scripts to continue.
Right, and you got only your part.
Right.
Yeah.
No one had a complete set. I mean, you know, you would have your cues, but then you would have your part. I guess I'm not comfortable with the idea of anybody taking a hard line that Shakespeare never intended for these to be published and bound, because I'm thinking, well, then how would some other acting troupe get the part and be able to put it on? And surely you can't. I'm not ready to say Shakespeare only wanted these actors to do it and nobody else. And so he was like, burn it all when I die.
No, yeah, it's a good point. Yeah, I don't.
I'm with Angelina. If I've read that in the book. Yeah, right, yeah. Right.
Bury them with me.
If I read in a book that Shakespeare opposed the publishing of the plays, I would just kind of flag that as
a reach by the author. Unless he wrote it.
Which would be tough to do from the other side of the veil.
No, but I mean, unless
he's talented as he was.
He may have written during his life. He may have written about, I mean, I'm sure he communicated with people about it. So, I'm not disagreeing with you guys at all.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, you know, I'm just thinking out
loud. It's just such a slippery slope when we start getting involved with what's the author's intention. I mean, Virgil's intention was to burn it. And thank God we didn't listen to that, you know? Like,
right.
No, yeah, yeah. Completely agree. Completely agree. I mean, the Aeneid's kind of meh, but. Shakespeare getting buried with his plays is like, that's like the most art becoming life thing I can imagine. Like, that's straight out of something a character in one of his plays would have done.
Yes, right.
It's a totally melodramatic Angelina move, so I respect it. I just don't think he would have done it.
All right, let's...
Kafka wanted the same things done. He wanted to burn all of his stuff. I think his friend had a... I think he actually requested his friend burn them after his death. And I'm glad that his friend disobeyed.
Well,
this is why I choose my friends very carefully with my orders for burning my stuff. Like, you got to be trustworthy.
Exactly.
I will haunt you.
So, I wonder if Shakespeare came back and haunted all his friends.
Well, that's why there's ghosts in his play, David. Come on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, duh. Hey, who's going to play the ghost but the ghost, right?
Right.
Oh, perfect.
So let's give some final thoughts here. We got to wrap
played
Mount
Julio in this play, speaking of the ghost.
Say again?
I read that Shakespeare played Malvolio in Twelfth Night, that this was his role.
David, didn't you ask that in the first podcast?
No, I think I mentioned it. I mentioned it. You said you didn't know.
I asked who played Bottom in Midsummer, because I thought they were often like the same people, like would play these clown, mm-hmm. clownish characters. I mean, I know he's not the clown, mm-hmm. but okay, let's wrap this up. We need to come up with some final thoughts here. So if you have any final thoughts to say, just hurry up and say them as we can get out of here.
I got no final thoughts, David.
I also have no final
thoughts. Good. Good.
David's just cracking the whip, and I'm feeling really nervous.
At least I waited till the end.
The Malbec to calm me down right now.
Yeah, thanks to everybody for the Malbec for Angelina. No, but we do need to wrap it up, so we shall do so. Thank you to everyone who's been contributing on Patreon. It's a big fundraising time for us. As you know, the end of the year is for most nonprofits. So I know you're probably getting money requests, like, you know, your mailbox is probably just full of them. You're just like overflowing onto your driveway, and you've mowed over them a few times and raked leaves over them and so forth. But if somehow ours manages to make it inside, we hope that you will consider contributing to our cause here. Your contributions, whether it's on Patreon or through our matching fund this year, go a long way to making sure that we can keep doing things like this. And pay our people and produce more resources and do more free stuff and all that kind of stuff. So your support goes a long way, and thank you for the support that you've given us so far. I speak for Angelina and Tim when I say thank you for contributing to the Patreon in particular as it relates to this show. And of course, to everybody, one more time, to everybody who contributed to those wonderful Christmas gifts. Wow. Thank you.
Oh, yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. David, okay. I did think of a final thought. Is it too late for me to say it? I'll be really fast.
Okay. Hurry up. Hurry up.
Well, Tim pointed out that, in an earlier episode, that we know a comedy is going to end with weddings, but the question of this play is who is going to end up being married to who. And I think it's really funny that Act Four ends with finally someone has locked down an engagement, but it's two strangers.
Yeah, that's a great point.
That is a good point. All right, well, so now we'll unravel all the rest of that through one more scene. Actually, Act Five is all one scene, so we'll talk about that next week, and then the week after that, the week after Christmas, I believe that would be, we will talk about your questions. So feel free to start sending us questions on the Facebook page or via email, and we'll start cataloging those for the Q&A episode. And then after that, we'll kick off the new year with a little discussion of the books that we read this year before we launch into Howard's End by E.M. Forster.
So I have a few weeks to really pad my reading list. I got to get cracking.
Oh, man, I'm doing the same thing. I'm reading like a lot of short books. and then, so this is what I'm thinking for after Howard's End, is I think I want to go ahead and do True Grit. I think I've been rereading it to make sure it's okay. I think that's the perfect book.
I'm going to admit this. I'm actually excited to read a Western. This is going to be a totally new genre for me. And I've been, okay, so a little tease there for when we get to True Grit. I have been walking around the last 3 days with a theory that the Western archetype is actually like the medieval King Arthur tale. So that's going to be our tease. That is going to be the way I enter this Western.
Nice.
All right. Well, as you know, I love a Western. So I will either agree with you or fight you on it, depending on how you present it. Also, just for some good old Western showdown here on the show. Tim, have you read
Well, we have to record every episode at high noon. but we're not on the same
where?
Team. Tim thwarting us again.
Tim, have you ever read True Grit?
I never have. I'm honestly fighting. I just want Cormac McCarthy to be in our conversation so badly that I'm just trying to get over that we picked a Western that wasn't.
It's
Mr. McCarthy.
But we are doing Cormac McCarthy, no?
True Grit's not by Cormac McCarthy.
No, no, no. All the Pretty Horses. I thought that's on our list of things we're doing this year.
It's on my list for 2018. So we'll get to it, Tim. We'll get to it. I also love Cormac McCarthy. So
I know you do. I'm wondering, like, what's the holdup? David, you love him as much as I do.
I'm bridging
this
gaps.
This is just so
I'm bridging
hilarious
gaps.
To be, Tim is dying to get into some major nihilistic violence and grit, and instead we're going to read Howard's End and we're going to have high tea.
Who said anything about nihilism?
It is definitely the misconception with him, in my opinion.
It is.
Okay.
Well, I can't wait then. Y'all correct me. I know nothing about him except from what I hear from you guys. Oh, and Justin. But other than that.
I'm making a list of books for 2018 to propose to you guys with a schedule for like 6 months of the year. So
I love it.
So we'll see how that works out.
Well, Tim might have a stroke if we don't get to Cormac McCarthy soon. So
we'll get around. Yeah, but we gotta keep the drama going. We gotta keep Tim's gotta be anxious about something, right?
That's right.
Yeah, that's what you feel like this show needs more.
More anxiety.
I have not been carrying that by myself. You feel like you're at the office like, what could possibly add more anxiety to the show?
Tim anxiety.
Tim anxiety. Right, well, he starts carrying his load. I will agree with that.
Well, yeah, exactly. We got to have like an anxiety mule. Just to, you know, fit in with the Western theme. So, all right, that's it. We should probably go ahead and end this episode for, you know, the two people who are still listening. For Tim McIntosh and Angelina Stanford, and for all of us here at Circe, I'm David Curran saying farewell. Thanks so much for listening to Close Reads, and we'll talk to you next week.